for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The 8.8 magnitude earthquake that struck Chile over the weekend has killed more than 700 people. But Haiti's 7.0 earthquake in January killed more than 200,000 people and destroyed large areas of the Caribbean nation. The starkly divergent outcomes of the two earthquakes are partly due to geology, but they also reflect differences in poverty levels, building standards, and preparedness. Joining me in the studio to talk about Chile, Haiti, and the science of earthquakes, Tim Beach of Georgetown University, Mike Blanpete of the U.S. Geological Survey, and James Whitcomb of the National Science Foundation. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send a short email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I wonder, Tim Beach, if you could start off by talking about the differences between what happened in Haiti and what happened in Chile.
Well, the first question we break down is the different kinds of plate boundaries that are in these two different places. The first of these in Haiti was more of a strike-slip fault.
And explain what that means.
It means that two sides of the Earth's crust are moving past each other in more or less a parallel way. And these produce large earthquakes, but usually not as large as the kind of earthquake that occurred in Chile, where we have a subduction zone, which means that produces things what sometimes we call megathrust earthquakes, wherein one section of the Earth's crust dives underneath another section of the Earth's crust, and it does this over a large area and so grinds the crust together, creating, in many cases, much larger earthquakes like this 8.8 that occurred in Chile.
Now, when you have an 8.8 that occurred in Chile and you have 700 people who die or are missing, there may be many more, and yet in Haiti you have such a larger population lost or dead. How do you explain that?
I think the main way we can explain that is several fold. One of them is the nearness to the actual epicenter of the earthquake. The largest population in Chile was farther away. Another part is simply the kind of per capita wealth of a country, the infrastructure that they have. And moreover, a third part, I would say, is the broader education of the public about earthquakes. We can't underestimate the importance of geographic and geoscience education to the public about how to deal with earthquakes, one, and two, how to prepare for them. That's just the beginning of the differences between these places, but it gives us a start to start discussing why there is such a loss of life difference between the areas.
Tim Beach, he's professor of geography and geoscience at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Now, turning to you, Mike Blanpete, as you look at the U.S. Geological Survey's Earthquake Hazards Program, you're looking all over the world to try to determine where the next earthquake is going to hit.
Yeah, the primary function of the USGS Earthquake Hazards Program is, of course, to concentrate on the domestic risk from earthquakes. But we do look worldwide, both because of our concern about the hazards for earthquakes across the globe and because looking worldwide, we can learn about earthquakes, as you say, different types of earthquakes, Haiti and Chile being examples, in order to bring those messages back home and learn both about why earthquakes occur where they do, when, and how big they will be, and also to give us experience in looking at how different building styles hold up when subjected to earthquakes. Chile gives us some opportunities to learn a number of lessons about construction styles, because frankly, Chile is a modern society. They have built much of their infrastructure in the last 20, 30 years. And so looking at how these buildings, which are modern, performed, will give us some real lessons on how to look at our own building infrastructure.
How many earthquakes has Chile suffered in the past?
Well, Chile is quite the active earthquake region. There have been probably a dozen magnitude 7 earthquakes over the century. Chile, in fact, is the home to the largest earthquake we know of. In 1960, just to the south of where this one struck, there was an earthquake measuring 9.5. And that was large enough to cause a significant tsunami crossing the Pacific and significant damage and quite a loss of life in Chile itself.
Now, there was a quite devastating tsunami expected in Hawaii. Why did that not happen as a result of what happened in Chile?
The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has the responsibility for tsunami warning. They operate a tsunami warning system. They take earthquake information coming from USGS and combine that with models for how the Earth's movement causes the displacement of water and the creation of a wave. Then they calculate how that wave will move across the Pacific. And they calculated that a tsunami of at least modest size would hit Hawaii, Japan, and so forth, which in fact happened. Fortunately, the impact of the tsunami was modest in those
How
areas.
How much prediction was there in regard to Chile's earthquake?
Well, prediction of that Chile will suffer earthquake hazards is really a no-brainer. It has in the past, and it will continue in the future. And anybody who looks at earthquakes will be able to tell that. The trick that people would like us to have is to predict when those would occur. And frankly, that's something that is outside the capability of earth science at this point. So our best bet is really to recognize that large earthquakes are coming, what those hazards will be, and to prepare for them.
Mike Blanton-Peed, he's at the U.S. Geological Survey's Earthquakes Hazard Program. Jim Whitcomb, how does the National Science Foundation figure into this question of earthquakes, where they may occur, how serious they may be, and so on?
Well, the National Science Foundation is one of the main funders of research at universities in the U.S., and may I say right now that we're close partners with the U.S. Geological Survey. In fact, Mike and I are on the same phone call almost every day since the Haiti earthquake and now the Chile earthquake. We work hand in hand. National Science Foundation is funding university researchers. In fact, I think one of the reasons that Chile is so advanced in terms of their preparation for hardening the infrastructure to earthquakes is that the Chilean scientists and engineers are quite advanced, and many of them were trained here in the United States under support of the National Science Foundation at universities. So I think that explains a lot of why Chile is so advanced in terms of their preparation for earthquakes. And in fact, their codes are so similar to ours that it's important for us in the U.S. to go down there and see how especially the modern buildings behaved in the earthquake, because their codes are very similar to the ones that we have in California.
What about the bridges? How did they hold up?
In Chile, from talking to people on the telephone and looking at pictures in the news, certainly the bridges and overpasses seem to have a lot of damage to them. And I think that that's probably, there are a lot of good lessons there, because for example, in the U.S. in the San Fernando earthquake and the Northridge earthquake in Southern California, which occurred just about in the same place, we had overpasses and bridges fall down also. And certainly in the U.S., Dan, you're probably well aware that the structure of the U.S. bridges, they're all getting older and they need a lot of repairs now. And so we expect that if we had a similar kind of earthquake in the U.S., that our infrastructure, including bridges, would behave about the same way.
Jim Whitcomb of the National Science Foundation's Division of Earth Sciences. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. As I understand what you have said, Jim, and both you and Tim seem to agree on this, that Chile has used U.S. models for construction to protect against earthquakes. But the question is, how much can one protect against earthquakes?
Well, that's a really good question, Diane. And earthquake engineering, and that's not my field, but I certainly do work with a lot of earthquake engineers. The earthquake engineering so far is trying to build our infrastructure so that it protects lives. Although when a big earthquake happens, it may be that the structure itself will not be usable after that point. And to go much further beyond that, to make sure that the structure is sound and usable after that, is quite a bit more expensive, but it certainly we need to do that for things like hospitals, schools, really critical things like that, and bridges, critical structures like that. So that's where we are in many parts of the U.S. in the earthquake-prone areas. And, of course, there are lots of areas in the U.S. where we are still just beginning to build earthquake-resistant structures.
Jim Whitcomb, he's head of the Deep Earth Processes section at the National Science Foundation's Division of Earth Sciences. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We were talking, of course, about the recent earthquakes, the first in Haiti, the more recent in Chile, where U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in Santiago today to offer that devastated country moral and material support as it recovers from the deadly disaster. Tim Beach, I want to ask you about population and the effects of population in these earthquake zones and how that may affect what happens in those zones.
Well, that's a great question, because what we've seen over the last 30 years or so is this rapid increase in urban populations around the world. By 2025, something like 5.5 billion people will live in cities, which is larger than the population of the Earth in 1990. A lot of that increase is occurring around developing world cities, many examples of which are the cities of northern India, which are right next to a very profoundly strong potential for earthquakes. Hundreds of millions of people live in those zones. There are many examples of cities that also have these growing populations in shanty towns around them as well. In Central America, for example, Guatemala City and Mexico City have large areas with very poor infrastructure, and many of these will go down immediately. The classic example is really Istanbul, because we have a long history of earthquakes in Istanbul, and we know they return at a fairly regular pace. And we also know that this city has grown by three times since 1985. Its population is about 13 million now. About 6 million of those people live in shanty towns who have come recently around these areas, and these areas will collapse in many cases when the next big earthquake occurs, which is predicted sometime in the next few decades for Istanbul.
So would you say that population is one of the predictors of earthquakes in the zones you're talking about?
It's not one of the predictors of earthquakes, but it's certainly one of the predictors of impacts of earthquakes in those zones, because there's so many cities that lie along those plate boundaries. And in fact, in developing world, again, lie along those plate boundaries. And they're growing very quickly because they're near coasts where humans like to live. They're in mountain valleys where humans like to live. They're in some of the best parts of the world that attract people. And we also know there's this massive migration towards cities, and cities are just going to be more dangerous because of all the infrastructure falling down and collapsing that will occur in large earthquakes in the future.
All right. Do the people who are moving into those areas understand that they are at risk for earthquakes? Mike Blanfield.
I would say probably in some cases, of course. I mean, and Chile being one example, that we have earthquakes, you know, every few years or more frequently, and so people feel them. People are aware of the fact of earthquakes. But even in our own California, it's, you know, decades between a major earthquake that affects the population. People lose track of that site, and in fact, there's so much other to worry about in life, mm-hmm. especially in a poorer area. That earthquakes may not rise to the top either in the personal experience and personal preparation or in that of the government.
Here's an email from James in Baltimore, Maryland. He says, are earthquakes becoming more frequent around the globe? Jim Whitcomb.
I think the short answer to that is no. Statistically, they vary from time to time, but there's no evidence that earthquakes are either increase or decreasing in frequency. And if we look at the cause, the major cause of earthquakes is motion of the plates and their release of strain along plate boundaries. And now that we, with space geodetic techniques, we can measure the motion of plates, we see that they're generally very steady with time, and therefore the energy that goes into causing earthquakes is very steady with time.
But the second part of his question is, I'm of the opinion that drilling for fossil fuels has perhaps caused the Earth's crust to become less stable. Is there any indication of that, Jim?
Well, when you drill, most drills go, drilling has depths that they can go down to maybe 6 miles or something like that. Most of the earthquake action and the strength of the crust is deeper than that. So, yes, if you drill down into the crust and you pump water in there, for example, there is evidence that you generate small earthquakes, and sometimes they reach moderate size. But drilling generally does not get down to the depths that are the areas of activity for large earthquakes.
What are the depths that it would take to generate that kind of problem?
Well,
this
is very controversial. I just had a conversation about that about 3 days ago with one of my colleagues. And I think in California, for example, you need to know what's happening down around 10 kilometers or 15 kilometers, which is like 6 miles or so. Some people think shallower, but certainly earthquakes go down to as deep as 600, 700 kilometers, which is, you know, how many miles is that, 300 miles or 400 miles? So certainly we cannot drill down to those depths, and the forces within the Earth are much greater than what we're really doing to drilling.
But I guess his question is, if you begin drilling down, say, 1 mile, does that begin to disturb what's beneath Tim Beach?
Well, I think Jim has given a good overview of that. And we get into these areas where we don't know, but it seems unlikely to cause the very large earthquakes. Another aspect of that, of course, are large reservoirs that we built over the last, especially the last 100 years, which changes weight differentials above faults, in some cases faults that we didn't know about before. And these do have potential to speed up the rates of earthquakes in some places. Again, not at this mega thrust size or in that kind of a process, but certainly enough to cause damage.
Mike Bland, Pete.
You know, just frankly, the scale of these large earthquakes that are causing the damage is just vast compared to the influence of man. Yes, it's true, as Jim pointed out, that when they do exploration drilling, production drilling, and so forth, sometimes there are small earthquakes created in the vicinity of the drilling. But frankly, the depths, the scales, the sizes of the forces involved in plate tectonics and the creation of these large earthquakes far outstrip our ability to influence them. You know, just as an example, if we were able to, say, drill down into the vicinity of at the great depth at which the Chilean earthquake occurred and influence the slip on that mega thrust, we're influencing the slip over the scale of a few meters. And yet this earthquake needed to take advantage of forces that had been built up over decades, over scales of hundreds of miles. And there's just, you know, once those stresses are relieved, it will take decades again for the plate tectonic process to build them up again. So it's really, I think there's more of a separation between the process of these large earthquakes and what we can do about them.
Explain, Mike, for me the process of the movement of these plates. Are they not constantly in motion?
They are. As you know, the surface of the Earth is broken into these large sections that basically float above the mantle. They're driven very slowly across the surface of the Earth by motions in the mantle. The movements are measured generally in fractions of an inch or a few inches per year, roughly the rate of your fingernails growing. And for example, you can picture your fingernails being inhibited from growing at a plate boundary for some decades, and then all of a sudden 60 years worth of fingernail growth spurts out of the end of your fingers all at once. That's the motion in the earthquake. And of course, you can imagine moving great volumes of earth that fast, that far, creates the big waves that travel through the earth and cause the shaking.
How can you know all this?
Well, we have been studying the earth geologists have been studying the earth for hundreds of years.
But you can't see these plates,
well,
can you?
Well, actually, we can. The movement of the plates leaves a very clear geologic record of the different rock types that are involved in the middle of the plates and the interactions along the edge. And as Jim pointed out, more recently, we actually now have the capability of directly observing the motion of those plates using GPS technology.
So the question becomes, when you observe something like fingernails growing at a pace 60 years of fingernail growth all at once, why can't you see that if you can see these plates in motion?
Well, we can certainly see the plates in motion, and we can calculate how much the stresses are rising on those boundaries between them. I think what you're asking is how can we know when the earthquake will occur? Well, the fact is we would need to know far too many details about the faults than we can possibly know sitting at the Earth's surface. We don't know exactly what the conditions are on the faults. We don't know what conditions it takes to begin that slipping process. It's just impossible to know from where we're sitting.
So as far as, say, California is concerned, what's happening out there? Do we know? Jim Whitcomb.
Well, Diane, I think you put your finger on really one of the more exciting things that's happened in our field in the last few years, and that is being able to measure the plates and the details of what's happening, because we're getting in a position now that we've made incredible strides in being able to measure plate motion and the details of the movements of plates by space geodetic techniques. And there are three that have revolutionized our field. One is very long baseline radio interferometry use of these giant antennas that NASA uses. You can use those measuring by means of quasars. But the GPS system is really the new revolutionary way that we're doing it now. And then there's something new that NASA is working on called satellite radar interferometry. Using satellites and radar, we can take pictures of the Earth's surface, and with time, we can measure down to very small distances the deformation that is happening in the crust. And what this is doing for us in earthquake research is that it's giving us the ability more and more to tell where earthquakes will happen. Now, as Mike said, we still haven't found that magic bullet that will tell us when. But telling where earthquakes can happen is really maybe more important because that enables us to tell the earthquake engineers where are the most critical places to go in and harden the environment. And it's really the built environment that is the most dangerous for people.
Tim Beach.
Well, Jim's entirely correct in his assessment of that. One other thing I would say is the historical record, which I mentioned before for Istanbul, a whole field of paleoseismology in which we use historical records, but also geomorphic, that is, Earth surface studies to look at change over time. And these have given us a much better idea of the return period or the recurrence interval of earthquakes of certain sizes. There's a whole group of different lines of evidence within the Earth that we can study. We do need more of those records, especially around developing world plate boundaries, but we have more of those, and we're building them up. I'll give you one example is tells in the Middle East in some cases are actually pulled apart by earthquakes, and so we can see how they've been displaced. Ancient canals around Tehran, for example, have been displaced by as much as 10 meters by earthquakes in the past. So these kind of physical, archaeological lines of evidence help us to build that record.
Tim Beach, Georgetown University. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, first to Somerset, Ohio. Good morning, David. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I have questions for your panelists in regards to the New Madrid Fault here in the United States. It's seldom discussed, and I'd like to know whether or not it's been monitored. Is being monitored. What type of plates are those at the Madrid Fault? And also, would it impact cities like Chicago and St. Louis? And I'll take my answer off here.
All right. Thanks for calling. Mike Blanpede.
Back in 1811, 1812, that winter, there was a series of several large earthquakes. By our understanding, they were at least magnitude 7 and may have been considerably larger. That struck that area. The area was rather sparsely populated at the time, but were those earthquakes to recur today, they would impact large populations, including Memphis, possibly St. Louis, and so forth. The geologists who have studied the area have found evidence preserved in the rocks of such sequences of earthquakes multiple times in the past, with hundreds of years separating them, and so it does look like a dangerous area. In addition, we have ongoing small and moderate earthquakes in the area that illustrate that this is a part of the world that is a hazard.
Tim Beach.
I would just add, too, that with that New Madrid earthquake in 1811, 1812, these effects of this were felt all over the east coast of the United States as well, and there was damage that far away, showing a much larger area of influence from New Madrid. Now, the question of when that'll return is a big question because it seems to be a fairly long return period, although there's a lot of work on that.
It's interesting. We're coming back up on the 200th anniversary of that earthquake sequence. And over the next couple of years, the residents of the area will see a lot of information coming out of the USGS, academic partners, and so forth about those earthquakes, about earthquake hazards in the central U.S. And there'll be public education, information, exercises, and so forth.
Interesting. We don't think of the central part of the U.S. as being earthquake prone.
Yeah, this is a really great question because we really understand why earthquakes happen on plate boundaries, but certainly the New Madrid area is not on a plate boundary. And this brings up the whole question of why we have earthquakes in the middle of plates. We've had them in New Madrid. We've had them along the East Coast in Charleston, Boston, up in north of New England and Canada. And frankly, we don't really understand why. And one of the things that the National Science Foundation is doing right now is a project called EarthScope, in which we are systematically working our way across the country with geophysical instrumentation to map the crust of the Earth. And it's just about to come into the eastern half of the U.S. And hopefully, with our partners in the U.S. Geological Survey and NASA, we'll be able to say a little bit more about why these earthquakes happen in the middle of a plate boundary.
There are an awful lot of listeners worried about the bridges and levees on the Mississippi River.
Well, certainly a big earthquake in that area would cause quite a bit of disruption. You know, we have good building codes in the U.S., but building codes change over time, and frankly, much of the country has a lot of infrastructure that has not been built recently. And the costs of both recognizing and fixing that problem are astronomical. It's a real problem.
Mike Blanfield of the U.S. Geological Survey. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, recognizing the importance of data to improve outcomes for children. On the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The ecology of our rivers, streams, and lakes. As part of our ongoing Environmental Outlook series, the unintended consequences of stocking the nation's inland waters with hatchery-bred fish, and a look at the invasive species threatening the Great Lakes. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. As we talk about earthquakes, plate tectonics, what's happening around the world, here's an email that reflects several questions that have come in. This one from Carlos, who says, I read that this quake shifted the rotation of the Earth. What is the effect of this in GPS devices and other electronics? James Whitcomb.
Yeah, that's a great question, and shows that this reader knows quite a bit about the rotation of the Earth. Anytime you move something on the surface of the Earth, it has an effect on changing the pole of rotation of the Earth. And so certainly something as big as a magnitude 8 to 9 earthquake will do that. And I'm not being an expert, I can't tell you how much that does, but that puts a wobble in the pole of the Earth, and it's probably of the order of centimeters of a motion of the pole itself.
So what does that mean?
It means that the information coming from GPS and these other space geodetic techniques will measure that wobble, and it will be published somewhere in the near future just how much the effect of the earthquake changed the wobble of the Earth.
Tim Beach.
Well, that's a good point. These mega thrust earthquakes have this kind of impact on these centimeter scales about, just like Jim was saying. They also have long distance teleconnections with other things. Earth changes. Things like groundwater levels are affected by this sometimes too at some distance away, which is probably more of a academic interest to us than it is a large scale important change.
Well, here's another question from Roberto in San Antonio. He says, how can it be that the earthquake in Chile was 500 times more severe than the quake in Haiti, and yet geologist rankings were 8.8 and 7.0, respectively? Isn't it time for a more mathematically meaningful way to rank earthquakes? Mike Blanpete.
Well, seismologists really do use a range of different ways of measuring earthquakes. The important thing in terms of its 500 times difference is the amount of energy that was released in the earthquake, and that, in fact, was a 500 times difference. Frankly, it's difficult to talk about earthquakes in terms of energy. We talk about, you know, dynes and centimeters and joules and so forth. Those numbers are cumbersome, and also the numbers of zeros involved become cumbersome. The difference in energy between a magnitude 1 earthquake, a magnitude 5, and a magnitude 9 are so gargantuan that we tend to use a compact scale, a logarithmic scale, to talk about them. And, you know, once we know we know what is represented by an 8.8 and a 7 and a 1 and a 5, then those numbers have as much meaning as the much more cumbersome ones.
I see. All right. Let's go to Boca Raton, Florida. Good morning, Mia.
Yes, good morning, Diane. I know your guests are scientifically minded, but it seems oftentimes people question only the geological or supposed climatic reasons for natural disasters. However, is anyone considering the spiritual implications for these happenings? And, for example, I say that the Bible predicts in Matthew 24:7 that in the last days that there'd be frequent disasters like earthquakes in diverse places. And can we really afford to take this out of the global conversation?
Thanks for calling. You know, I think there are a lot of people out there who wonder whether one natural disaster following another has some deeper spiritual message for us humans here on Earth. What do you think, Tim?
I think if you look at the long-term record, you see this very large earthquakes over a long period of time, and you don't see any kind of increase. And I think that's the quick answer for it. And I think I would leave it at that.
All right. To Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Nina.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely. Go right ahead.
Yes, my question is, I'm wondering about the effects of climate change and global warming on plate tectonics when ice is melting and all of that weight of the ice is getting redistributed as fresh water into our oceans and losing the weight at the polar ice caps.
Interesting question, Tim.
You know, that's a great question in many ways. One of them is underscored by what I talked about earlier, and that is this, you know, vast growth of people, numbers that are moving into areas that are vulnerable along coasts, along plate boundaries. And so what we see is this increase in the impacts of natural hazards over the last 100 years or so because more people are moving to vulnerable areas. Now, at the same time, we know on the long scale that with big glacial changes from the past glaciation to present, it would have influenced some earthquake motion along the way. But I think on the smaller scale, it's probably at a small level. But Jim and Mike may know more about that.
Jim Whitko.
Yeah, it's a great question. Yes, the Earth is responding. If you melt a glacier, As Tim said, the Earth will respond, and actually around the Great Lakes and north of the Great Lakes, the Earth is rising now because the glaciers were melted several thousand, 12,000-13,000 years ago, and it's still going up close to a centimeter a year, and the same thing is happening in Sweden and Finland. That's going up at a centimeter a year, so that's like 3 feet in 100 years, and if we, for example, melt the glacier on Greenland, the Earth will change its shape in response to both the removal of ice there and the extra water in the oceans.
Mike Blanton-Pede, what is the average number of earthquakes in a given decade?
Well, the rate of earthquakes over time is rather constant, with, of course, some just natural variation. Just as an example, we get something on the order of 13 to 15 magnitude 7 earthquakes around the globe every year, so 10 times that in a decade, and a handful of magnitude 8 or larger earthquakes in a decade.
And depending on where they occur and what the structure is, sometimes they're devastating, and sometimes people don't even know.
Exactly. Many of those magnitude 7 plus earthquakes occur out in the ocean around the Pacific, and nobody feels them at all. But as Tim pointed out, there are many, many cities around the world now that have a large population at risk, and these cities really are targets. And every once in a while, the Earth hits a bullseye, and that's what happened in Haiti. The Earth hit a bullseye on a vulnerable city, and as a result, we have a catastrophe.
So the most vulnerable places on Earth right now are, Tim?
Well, I would say that if you look at any of the plate boundaries and those that we have good evidence for historical return periods, I think that Tehran is often used as the classic example because we have so many return earthquakes through this zone. It's laced with different faults right under the city. Population is about 10 million. It's just like, not just like, but similar to Istanbul. Millions of people have moved in over a short period of time in poor construction. And so it's, I hate to use it, a ticking time bomb, but Istanbul is as well. I think Guatemala City is. I think Caracas. I think Lima. And there are others as well. There's one in the United States that's of real concern to me beyond New Madrid and Memphis and St. Louis, and that would be the Cascadia zone around Seattle. We've only really recently become knowledgeable about how large past earthquakes have been on that particular section, and it's been through this paleoseismology again. We've learned that in 1700 there was a very large earthquake that coincided approximately with a tsunami in Japan, and we do expect a return period maybe of around 500 years. It's been 300 years or so since that happened. But, of course, that's speculation on the actual return periods based on a limited record.
And when was the last earthquake Tehran experience?
Well, Tehran has had a number of them over the years in the 6 to 7 category. But these relatively small on the scale of, say, Chile earthquakes can do a tremendous amount of damage in an environment like Tehran. And so people have actually argued that maybe we should just move Tehran. I say the government has thought about it, and seismologists in Iran have actually called for that at different times in the past.
If you move that entire population, wouldn't you render yet another area equally as vulnerable?
Well, possibly, but you could find areas that aren't as vulnerable to earthquakes. But at the same time, it would be a huge undertaking to move a city like that.
Jim Whitcomb, with the kind of research that the National Science Foundation is funding, can you predict how long it will be before scientists can predict an earthquake?
Well, when you say predict, I assume you mean predict the timing of the earthquake.
And alert people to get out.
Yeah. There's a couple of schools of thought there. I think that there are many scientists who say that there are physical principles that will prohibit us from ever predicting the time of an earthquake because earthquakes are something that are complex phenomena. And there's a physical term that means that it's not predictable in detail. Other people still have hope that maybe we might be able to see clues before an earthquake. And some earthquakes do have clues, like foreshocks and things like that, but not all the time. And so I think it's really the cutting edge of research, and we don't really know yet.
How long did the earthquake in Chile actually last, Mike Blanpete?
I don't know an exact time. It was several minutes. In terms of the time it took for the breaking to occur, probably the shaking in any one place was strong for on the order of 1 to 2 minutes.
And as the shaking occurs, that's when the construction begins to disintegrate.
That's right. A small earthquake will cause a sudden jolt. A large earthquake will cause a sustained shaking, and oftentimes it's that sustained shaking that weakens the structure and eventually causes the great damage.
And what do you say to people who are experiencing that kind of either quick shake or sustained shaking? What do you say to them in terms of finding safety, Tim?
It's somewhat dependent on where you are, but if you're in a place that has good zoning, the best thing to do is to stay inside next to a strong wall without things that are on that wall, but also under a table, a very strong table, look for that, and to cover your head with whatever you can. I bike around, so I always keep my biking helmet around. Not that Washington is a particularly active place, but I also come from California and know that it's good to put that on.
Has Washington ever experienced an earthquake that we know of?
I think there was a magnitude 4 in Virginia, close in one of the suburbs, not too long ago.
2004.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Sonia. You're on the air.
Hi, Dan. I just wanted to make a point regarding what I heard in your preview regarding the Chilean government not declining international help. It's not that they were declining the help. What they were saying at the beginning is that they wanted to make sure where they needed the help the most in order to get the help. So that, you know, it's not because it sounds very arrogant that they say they declined the help.
Yes, I understand your point, Sonia, and I think Tim wants to make a comment.
I think you're completely right, Sonia, in that case. The other thing is that earthquakes happen in politically turmoil, times with turmoil as well. You have a changeover in the government occurring just over the next couple of weeks in Chile. So we can't predict those when they're going to occur and when they're going to occur due to the politics that are going on.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Columbia, Maryland. Good morning, Alex.
Hi, Diane. My question was, I've heard that not only the magnitude, but also the difference in the way the plates interact can have different outcomes. For example, if they go over or under each other, if they just bump into each other. And if that's the case, was that a factor in the different levels of destruction seen in Haiti and Chile? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, sir. Thank you. Mike Blanpete.
That's absolutely right. The very largest earthquakes that we get on the planet, the ones that are up in the 9 range, are where we've got the plates colliding with each other. The Pacific is trying to dive its way, shove its way underneath South America. And we have great stretches of that plate boundary that release all at once in these huge earthquakes. Where the plates are rubbing against each other in more of a parallel fashion, what we call a strike slip fault of the type we have in California with the San Andreas, that's where we can get earthquakes up into the magnitude 7 and 8 range. And in that, in fact, was what happened in Haiti with a magnitude 7.
And Chile?
The Chile is the thrusting kind, the subduction earthquake where it's really the Pacific is trying to get underneath South America and having a great deal of trouble doing so.
All right. And finally to Langsberg, Michigan. Good morning, Al. You're on the air.
Hi. There's one element that I haven't heard mentioned is that there was an interaction with the solar wind stream where the interplanetary magnetic field turned southward in a jolting way and the phi value, which is the strength of the magnetic field, spiked. The wind speed, solar wind speed, and temperature spiked. And this interacts with Santiago in a way that it's inside a mapped zone of reverse polarity called the South Atlantic Anomaly. And I think that the interaction here is shown in three different people that I heard interviewed said that they came out of the building and there were auroras in the sky. So I think there's an indication of the interaction with the solar wind stream at the South Magnetic Pole.
Interesting. What do you say, Jim?
Yeah, well, the South Magnetic Anomaly is certainly a real phenomenon, and there the magnetic field is greatly reduced. In fact, satellites that travel over that part of the world actually get a lot of damage because the magnetic field doesn't protect the Earth as well there as elsewhere from the solar wind. And it's due to something happening in the core of the Earth. There's something happening with the way the magnetic field is generated that is reducing the field in that place. In fact, it's reducing it so quickly it's going down faster than if the field were completely turned off. So there's a real active thing going on there, and it has something to do with the details of the circulation within the liquid core of the Earth, but we don't really understand the details of that. But whether that's really connected with earthquakes or not is not established that I know of.
Jim Whitcomb of the National Science Foundation, Michael Blanpede of the U.S. Geological Survey, and Tim Beach of Georgetown University. Fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diane. Here.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.